Welcome to another episode of Chaos to Clarity, where I interview leaders of some of the world's best tech companies about the strategies and principles that it takes to build a successful business. If you want to find more episodes or free resources to help you grow your business, just go to chaostoclarity.io. All right, welcome back to another episode of Chaos to Clarity. I am Eric Weiss, and I'm here today with Daniel Mirashalian, co-founder and CTO of Drata. Daniel, how are you doing today?
Great. Thanks for having me.
So good to have you on the show. You know, one of sort of the big dogs in the San Diego tech ecosystem. You know, I've been following your journey kind of since the beginning, but, you know, it's really exciting to kind of hear from your side the story of Drata. So why don't you maybe just sort of give me a little bit of background on yourself and then sort of what's that founder journey origin story that got you to found the company?
Yeah, of course. I'll keep it relatively brief. Let's see. I'll round back to this in a second, but I grew up in a little weird town called Sedona, if you've ever heard of it, a little tourist town.
I got married in Sedona. I love it.
Awesome. Yeah, I grew up there. So yeah, a little hippie tourist town. But again, I'll come back to that in a sec. So grew up a classically trained programmer, went to, you know, have a computer science degree, and went into the industry, when did I start? 2004. And the reason why I say that is 2001 was the dot-com crash. So I started university before in the dot-com boom and then exited in the crash. And so, you know, while you're going into university and figuring out what you want to do as a young kid, it was like, whoa, this is really exciting. And the internet and the boom and okay, let's do that. And then on the exit, it was like, oh shit, I got to find a job. Like the salaries are probably cut in like 70% or whatever. So I landed at a community college in the Phoenix area. And we were actually building learning management systems before like Blackboard and Canvas were even a thing. And so it was pretty cool to like big data volume and scale and importance for, you know, the lives of 60,000 students. And so that was really fun as a first role into there. And while that, I think, kicked off my love for programming and the internet and big data processing, it was an interesting role because it just didn't, just didn't fit my vibe of like, just being in this box and like having this bureaucracy of this university. And while I think there was great people there, it was just this like very bureaucratical kind of thing. And then on the flip side, you also had employees that were just like literally there for their pension. Like they're decent at what they did, but like in at 8:30, out at 4:30, like don't care after 4:30. And so while I'm trying to learn and absorb every single thing I can as a, you know, new member in the industry, it was just like, it was hard to learn fast. And so I couldn't even imagine now with the like remote culture and the COVID kids and like, you got to be around people to learn. So, you know, I definitely feel for that generation, but so fast forward there, got a master's degree in leadership and realized that I was like, I got to do my own thing. And so from there, I've been starting companies. So it's almost been 20 years now. But the reason why I brought up the Sedona thing was back to that like entrepreneur journey. I feel like that's kind of where it started from. If I continue to do reflection on it in my life, is that in Sedona, it's a small town. It's like less than 10,000 people. It's a tourist, you know, driven economy. You go there as a tourist, people fall in love with it. They want to move there and they leave within a year. And the reason is there's no work for them. Now, maybe that's changed a little with the remote culture and tooling, but you know, so my mom, she was a pharmacist. She was in the community serving the community, but like most of my friends, all their parents were entrepreneurs. So you grew up around it, helping them or just, you know, kind of through osmosis there. And not, again, it wasn't a thing I sought out to do, like going into college and beyond. It just kind of was like this natural progression, I think, of like this makes sense to me. So that was, yeah, where it happened. And then, you know, as one company led into the next, it wasn't ever like this is what I want to do is build and sell companies. But it just kind of was like these amazing people you built companies with and became close to and wanted to continue to work with. And just, you know, one idea kept leading into the next after whether it was a business failure or a success on an exit or something like that. So
tell me about your most catastrophic business failure before Drata.
Well, the company was a success from a startup perspective. It was called Tweet Photo, and then we later changed the name to Plixi. But I mean, we raised like, I should know all this, like 1.8 million in venture, and we sold for 10. So it was, you know, small is good. A small team is 8 people at the top. But so while that was a success, in the middle of all that, we had the blocking trademarks to like tweet and like, because we were building a photo, like we were the team that put media onto Twitter. And so while now, if everyone will X now, so if you go on X and all you see is like videos and photos, you could, you know, either love me or hate me for that. So I was part of my team that we did that. But in that process, we were like my founder and CEO, he's like kind of like this business MBA litigious guy. And so, he had all these like block trademarks. And as like, and I think Ev and Jack and those guys early Twitter, like weren't, they're just devs coding some cool shit. And we had the blocking trademarks to some of that stuff. And our biz dev guy, we were trying to partner with them. And it was like a weird relationship with us and Twitter. But we were trying to partner with them. And in this like lore of partnership, we ended up giving them the trademarks. And I was just like, guys, this is worth more than our company. And like, no one believed me. And now, I mean, maybe it doesn't matter now. It's called X. But back then, yeah. So that was the one where it was like, nothing to do with the product or tech, but protecting like brand, especially if you're around a different brand, like you're like a second degree from something.
So this wasn't a failure on your part. You're saying if you're Jack Dorsey, watch out for guys like you. Okay, yeah. Got it.
Yeah. Just make sure at least, I mean, I'm not, patents are interesting, but at least trademark your brand. Like, I mean, look at, you know, Lovable within a year, they have 100 million ARR. Like, hey, that's never happened before. But what if like Lovable didn't have trademark protection and patent, like, and you know, someone's taking their brand or reputation that they just built the fastest growing company of all time. Like, that'd be bad. So, yeah. You know, at minimum, go on LegalZoom.com and spend $100. But and, you know, hopefully, go to your lawyer. So
and renew them too, right? I remember hearing a story of you know, several companies who they don't automatically renew their domain registration. Wow. And then like the day it expires, somebody goes and snatches it up. And they
that happened to Google, Amazon. I think within the past decade. Yeah. Yeah. I think the guy that got it though, like hooked them up and gave it to them. That's brutal. So those are,
so tell me about the origin of Drata. How did you find this opportunity?
Yeah. So in that stream of companies, the last business, Adam, my current co-founder and CEO, we started a business called Portfolium here in San Diego about 12 years ago or something like that. And it was, think of like LinkedIn for college students. Mm-hmm. So we were building that up, giving all these students an e-portfolio to showcase all of their amazing work and efforts and learnings in an effort to connect it to an opportunity, whether that was a job, whether it was your master's program, whatever it may be. And it was working, you know, like we started from the bottom up, more guerrilla marketing. And in that journey, we eventually figured out that wasn't paying the bills. But what did pay the bills was going selling to the universities under some specific initiative, just depending on the university and their grants and initiatives. It might have been the dean or provost or president. It might have been the career center director. It all depends. But at the, you know, fast forward into I should know all the dates, 2019-ish, 2018-ish. We had about 400 universities, millions and millions of students, and it was working and it was scaling. And we went, you know, the first like bit of the company, it was a slow grow. We raised some money. We were figuring it out. We started making some money and okay. But then like that last year, it really accelerated. We almost tripled revenue. And at that point, it was like raise a B round to continue the success. An amazing opportunity came on with selling to Instructure, the makers of Canvas. So we were working with them in the field, like selling their learning management system and our e-portfolio solution side by side. And I think just a strategic investment in us made sense to them as they were growing. So we ended up selling the business to them. But if you back up just a bit before then, like GDPR came out a year or so prior, in the online education online education and internet kind of applications dealing with people under 13, there's like the COPE, like the Child Online Protection Act. There's there's too many acronyms. FERPA, it's like federal. I should know all this stuff, but it's like student data protection. Obviously GDPR around the privacy in the European Union. CCPA came out. So all of these acronyms and acronym soup that I just keep calling the compliance hammer. And then at the same time, we were selling to all these universities. And, you know, maybe the first 50 universities, the CIO or someone like that in the procurement process of they're like, hey, I heard amazing things about this tool. My provost is thumbs upping it. I got to do my job. And how are you going to protect my student data? And at the time, I mean, it was like, we're on AWS. Everything's all good. And it was like, surprisingly, that actually worked half the time, which is, you know, maybe not the best in the security of these universities. But B, they would send us these giant security forms or whatever it may be. And so after hearing this 50 times and saying, do you have a SOC 2 or a certain, you know, ISO 27001 certification process, we had, okay, it was like, all right, enough is enough. I'm tired of being up until 3 a.m. filling out the security forms. Let's go do the thing. So you go do the thing. We're a smaller firm to go get a SOC 2 report and go through the audit process in preparation for all that. You don't know what you don't know. You hire consultants. You rip some engineers off the roadmap to go do whatever. And it's disruptive to the innovation of a young startup. Now, the outcome of that is a report at the end of the day, an attestation that you can use to help prove your security program to buying parties and build trust. And that helped accelerate deal flow. So while the average ed tech deal flow is like 18 months on average, ours was like 90 days. So our sales team's kicking ass with everything we could do to help accelerate these pipelines. But it was if you step back, it was really cool to see as an entrepreneur, like, whoa, this compliance thing, this compliance hammer that we keep getting hit on with COPPA and FERPA and the ADA, the Accessibility American Disability Act, and now SOC 2, like all these things that we would adhere to in the product and process was accelerating these deal flows and becoming actually an arrow in our quiver in the sales cycle.
So Drata really was built within Portfolium.
Yeah.
And then as Portfolium exited, you went off and said, okay, let's take this thing.
Yeah. So that's world. Like where we got. So then we sold to Instructure and great. You know, you kind of, as you go into a new company, it's usually go in, hopefully, and I learned this a few times. So maybe we'll go back to this lessons learned of selling a company. But I went in over the top with open arms into Instructure of just like, very positive, enthusiastic, like, even though this is my baby I sold, hey, let's do it for the greater good of Instructure and Canvas and all the students. And let's meet all the teams and do everything they can and just go above and beyond. So I was working with the security and compliance team there. And even though there's an amazing security team when I was there, it was like, okay, I'll go do the SOC 2 stuff. And I got a million Jira tickets and screenshots I had to do and meetings. And it was just kind of like, this is a little crazy because this is how I did it at the 45 person startup, not at a 1,500 person enterprise. Mm-hmm. And whatever, you go do it. And then you learn, you go through the next year and the next cycle came around and it was like, hey, I think we can automate some of this stuff. And because it was a lot, right? I mean, it's a big, big enterprise. You had to deal with a lot of stuff. So it was like, AWS has all these APIs, GitHub has all these APIs, Okta has all these APIs. So maybe we could like start automating it around that same time. Instructure actually got bought by a PE firm, and that we left the business at that process and started Drata. So as Adam, myself, and Troy, our other co-founder, Troy was running our sales program at Drata or at Portfolium. So he is co-founder and running go-to-market at Drata. We were all like, okay, what do we want to do and sell? We really like the B2B space. We feel like we worked well in the past 7-8 years doing that. We knew we wanted to go find and build a painkiller, not a vitamin. And I think Portfolium was a vitamin to the education systems and student success, where we wanted to go build a painkiller, something that just someone absolutely hates and will pay money to get rid of this problem. And all roads kind of kept coming to supporting engineers and, you know, the security people in there and this problem that we faced, which was like this compliance hammer. Let's go automate it for our peers. So that was kind of the birth of Drata.
Wow. Okay. So like if I'm a startup in security and compliance is always kind of the last thing on my mind. I'm just focused on building the thing. So, but what you're saying is hey, if my sales process is getting locked up by not having certain compliance, when, at what point should I start thinking about implementing something like this?
Absolutely. Yeah, regardless of Drata or not, you don't need Drata to go do an ISO 27001 process, right? It's like a security framework from the International Standards Organization that kind of says, hey, you're going to host customer data in the cloud. You don't own the network and the controls and the servers anymore. You should follow these programs and processes to ensure you're running a good, secure program, right? Mm-hmm. No one's forcing you to do it. It's not a law. Now, things like HIPAA, GDPR, CPRA, the California Privacy Act, those are laws, right? SOC 2, ISO 27001, NIST 853, like the government stuff, they're like industry certs, industry practices. Right. But if you're going to go and make a startup, to like a B2C startup, and you're going to, I don't know, off the top of my head, help, I don't know, people find dogs, whatever, like the people aren't going to care. Maybe they care that you're like doing it secure. Sure. That's a cool story you can tell, but like, I don't think it's really going to hurt you. If you're going to go sell and build a startup for like, I mean, the new hot trend is AI, right? And like enterprises are spending a lot of money on AI and you want to go target the Fortune 5000 or maybe like commercial accounts, kind of like Drata, we're roughly 700 employees or so. Like, okay, you're going to go try to sell to Drata. My security team won't even talk to you unless you have a security program. If we're going to pass, you know, data through you to you. So that I would say the earlier, the better. Obviously depends on your business, who you're selling to. But if you're going to go sell to businesses, it's spidered down from, I don't know the exact time window, but like 12, 15 years ago, like the SOC 2 program came out of the AICPA, which is American Institute of Certified Professional Accountants, the CPAs, right? That's the people that
we're going to have to make a whole glossary to go.
Yeah, we do. We do. It's like acronym soup in my head. But the CPAs that you go do your taxes with, right? This is the organization that certifies all those people. So all the businesses were going to them for like financial audits. And they're like, hey, we're starting to put all these workloads in the cloud. Maybe we could start a program and process and train up auditors to ensure the proper security around this. So that's the SOC 2 program, or SOC 1 is more financial. So in that world, it's a good program to start. And if the earlier you do it, the easier it is. And then as you hire new people, as you bring on new servers, as you deploy new software like an Okta or GitHub or whatever, it just becomes part of the culture of how we automate this evidence. And then you'll wake up one day and you'll have a good sized business and it'll all be automated through a tool like Drata, where those frameworks that you have to, that you want to adhere to help accelerate your sales cycles. It's just easy. Now, at the same time, I'm talking and focusing on sales. It is a great tool for that. I mean, the output of it is you run a well-oiled machine and a better secure program for sure.
Yeah.
But a lot of times people think, SOC 2 or whatnot, it's kind of like a check the box and a sales tool, which they're not wrong. I wouldn't say 100% right, but it's almost like the key to the party. Like you can't get into the party unless you have the key. So it's like having a SOC 2 program or ISO 27001 or some equivalent. It like sets the framework up to run a good security program. Yeah. You could run a security program without doing compliance, but I would say that wouldn't be, I think, the best bang for your buck when you look at the end-to-end spectrum of running a business. Mm-hmm.
So I have an anecdote along the lines of this. So I'm an executive coach, and I actually work a lot with healthcare companies. And I had one client that was in the kind of prescription drug benefit space, and they were high trust compliant, but high trust was their requirement to be in business, and, just another acronym. Mm-hmm. But the CTO, this was like a Series B stage company. So relatively small in terms of headcount, but they, they just raised, I think, $20, $25 million and they were getting ready to scale up. And the CTO was basically doing certification as a full-time job for about half of every year. So every single year they had to get re-upped or recertified or whatever the terminology is. And he said it took him about 6 months of work.
Yeah.
Almost full time, kind of a ramp up. But there was basically half the year where he couldn't build anything. He couldn't hire anybody. He couldn't do anything else except doing this compliance. And so, you know, he came to me just with his, you know, pulling his hair out and didn't know what to do. I said, well, can't you hire somebody to do this? Like, if it's basically a full-time job, then there's got to be somebody. Okay, light bulb went off. You know, sometimes my job is so easy. Like, does that suck? How about you stop doing that?
Yeah, I mean, there's variation. So I don't want the listeners, you know, that are starting a company or have a Series A company to get freaked out. Like, oh my God, I have to go spend 6 months of my life on this sock tooth thing or whatever it may be. There are variations to it, right? Like, I think HITRUST is on the high end of the spectrum. Same with FedRAMP. NIST 853 is like the government groups. Yeah, too many acronyms. I forget what NIST stands for, something institute anyway. But like, those are a little bit more complex and hard, right? Not to say SOC 2 is nothing, but I think with a tool like Drata, it kind of makes it a nothing burger. Like, we automate 80-90% for the startups.
So but to finish off, because it ties to your earlier point, so we ended up hiring this CSO basically that, you know, took care of this and everything else. But what the big kind of unlock was okay, now that we don't have to deal with all of this compliance kind of rigmarole, the auditing and so on, then he actually started to bring in a culture of security.
Yes.
And that's where, you know, all of a sudden I was like, oh, actually, you know, we have a really important responsibility here to take care of people's data and to protect our own systems and things like that. And that's where it actually became like meaningful. I don't, you know, it's not fun or anything, right? But it became like really meaningful. It was like, wait a minute, you know, at first it was just this absolute slog and something they hated doing to kind of reach this bar. But then it's like, kind of like, once you're in the party, you can be like, yeah, actually we earned this. And so
I think one of the coolest things I've seen, in, we have around 8,000 customers or so. I mean, a lot of them are startups. It's great to support large enterprises up to the Fortune 100 down to literally one person startups are on the platform too. It's really cool to see the spectrum. But in the startup group, in the SMB group, I've seen it countless times now where you would work with the company and it's a slog. It's this damn thing I have to do. I'm trying to close this deal. I have to do it to close the Bank of America deal, whatever it is. And no one has time for it. It's the CXO. It's a founder. It's whatever. And they go do it. And Drata helps them obviously make it way faster. That's great. But they do it. And then they have never, like, it was like a CEO or like a CTO like me, but that's never been in that world. And then they go do it and they go, oh, that wasn't too bad. And then they go, oh, I'm in the party now. That's kind of cool. I have this responsibility. And exactly what you said, security becomes starts becoming part of the culture versus this thing in the corner that's an expense. And I've seen it time and time again on people's like websites. Cultural values about the company, like after they deploy Drata, security actually becomes a new cultural value of the business. So I think as obviously building a business, you want customers and revenue, and that's great. But I love supporting the community, not only the entrepreneurs, but the users of all these amazing new tools and seeing like our efforts to securing the internet is pretty cool.
Nice. So you said, you know, you've grown up to 700 employees. I always love hearing about kind of the growing pains, right? Because going from that early startup and all of a sudden you've got a bigger team and systems start to break and whatnot. What were some of kind of the biggest PTSD moments for you from scaling up the company?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, we were extremely hyper growth. I would say like we've, from a percentage perspective, slowed down in the past year or so compared to the first three. We're still growing, but just not percentage wise the same, where we were literally doubling the company every 6-8 months. In that crazy growth spurt, those first 2.5 years, it was like every process, maybe this isn't 100% true statement, but like every process that we had just snapped in half, like every single month. So hiring process, like, so from like basic things of like how to hire people, how to onboard people, how to offboard people, how to train people, how to do communication, how to do all hands meetings, like all these things of like how do you communicate down. All of a sudden, it was really hard to get all my team, like all the engineers together. Like I think if you have a group of even like 40 in a remote, I mean, imagine not in a remote environment. Like what office space or room, conference room, do you have that will fit 40 people? Like, right. Not too many. And I have like 250-ish now rolling up to me, maybe a little bit more. Like, what, unless you have some giant auditorium type thing in your office, which, you know, big companies do, but like, otherwise you're not getting people together. Now, remote's great and we can get on Zoom and that's easy, but like the time allocation of just grabbing 250 people for 30 minutes and like that needs to be so important and impactful that I'm disrupting 250 people's jobs. So I start thinking like that a little differently as we've been scaling. I think some of the other teams, like, you know, our biz dev team has like 30 people or something. Marketing has like 30. I forget the exact counts, but like, it's a little easier to grab 30 people, but like the bigger teams, like all of sales, all of engineering, like it's a little harder. So we have to be very kind of mindful of the content, like the time, cause we're obviously there's a lot of pressure and work on everyone.
Yeah. So, well, especially in the tech world, engineering is often the team that sort of scales up the most. And it's also a very complicated workflow, process. So what were some of the things that, you know, were the biggest unlocks for you in terms of being able to scale up engineering?
Yeah, we hit around, let's say like 100 people in R&D. So that's product and everyone, right? The whole gamut. And I feel like that's where my mind couldn't keep up with it anymore. And I probably didn't hire soon enough or promote or whatever it was soon enough to start like layering and in the org. It was almost like all of them just rolled to me at that time. My product peer is a peer to me. So all the product people go there, but we work as one big unit and like we have a pod model. So like, you know, it's kind of like that Amazon two pizza pod kind of concept. So it was like when we got to about 100 people, it was like, I literally can't like keep stream of the work. It was just too much going on in one head to like be ingrained in the details. Obviously, even at today's scale, our tech org's like roughly 300 now. A little more. And it's like, I know all the work streams going on, but I don't know all the exact little details. And so in that world, it was like, probably didn't hire fast enough and like layer it in. And so around then I started doing it and, you know, it takes time to ramp. And we hired some great, great people that have helped us scale and build and distribute and take ownership. And so that's been great. That was one thing I think that like broke early on. Another thing would be really understand your customer. And I would say that's something that we're maybe dealing with now compared to the first, call it 2-3 years of the company. First, just call it chapter one, chapter two of the company, wherever you draw the line. Chapter one was like, find a product market fit, and which we did find extremely fast. But regardless of that, it was like, okay, now like go build for that and scale and grow the customer base and understand revenue and metrics and blah, blah, blah. And we did that. And at large, they were all small companies. Like, let's just say companies under 1,000 employees, right? And as we went into chapter two, it was like, hey, we realize everything we need to start doing is we need to start looking towards the enterprise. And so it was like, back in the day, like, yeah, so whatever, 2 years ago, we kind of like set the bar at like 500 plus employee companies. Okay, we really got to start understanding the workflow and streams of these companies in the GRC space, which is what we're in, the governance, risk, and compliance. And if you're going to go hire a CISO, like what are their pains and what do we need to help automate? And so we started doing that. And then as time went on, every 6-8 months or whatever it was, we kept raising that bar. And so now when we think about enterprise, you know, there's definitely a bar. I mean, there's the Fortune 100, right? That is different. Mm-hmm. And we have a few of those, which is great. But like the core bulk of like where marketing goes out, where sales is focused, you know, there's a range. And then engineering tries to think a little ahead of that range. But what's really great is like you're seeing these Fortune 5000 companies come inbound that we're not like directly targeting in a marketing sense. But they're coming inbound because they really love what we're doing. And sales is obviously talking to them. That's really cool. And sometimes we hit these like really complex limits that these third-party tools. And what we do, very high level, super high level, is we help collect the evidence automatically for these compliance programs. So we help you set your program, then we help prove your program. So in the proving the program, let's just say you use Intune. Microsoft Intune is a device management tool from Microsoft. And we want to understand how you manage all your laptops or devices, you know, desktop computers. So we can actually go to Intune's APIs and get information about all your devices and understand how they're configured. And are they configured properly per the policies of that you've set in Intune? Well, Microsoft Intune was built more for like the actual management of the devices, not for someone like me in compliance that's trying to understand how you're configuring it. So the way the APIs are structured are like not the best for us. Like I feel like normally I can maybe, let's just say easy math, there's 1,000 employees. Maybe I could go make like a few API calls and iterate through those 1,000 employees and it has all of those data points that I need to assert. Well, Microsoft Intune's APIs just isn't built like that. I have to, for those 1,000 employees, I probably have to make upwards of like 100,000 to 500,000 API calls. So now all of a sudden I have to deal with rate limits and data pulling. And then Intune, as we go up and up and up, we're actually dealing with a customer right now that has 30,000 employees and they use Microsoft Intune. Also, Microsoft Intune has like these like limits on rate limits of their system that aren't just for the developers. It's also for their internal systems. So now we're fighting with this company's internal use of Intune and us. And like, so this is like my point was understand your customer and where you're going. If you know you're going to go to the Fortune 5000, awesome. You have to like hire for that early on, which is hard to do because you're going to go try to hire someone that has done it and built it and scaled it before, but they're going to join a company that has none of that momentum. They need to go build it. So you're going to have to go find a very unique individual that like understands their experience of past, but like wants to change a little bit and move forward in the future, but use that knowledge to scale. And I would say, not to say Drata doesn't have amazing smart people that have done things in the past, but at large, right, the customer profile that we've been building towards is maybe like the up to 5,000, maybe 10,000 type employees, like an Okta or CrowdStrike. When you start dealing with like 30,000, 100,000 employees, the deeper complexities, it's a little bit more. So we're starting to like really dive into those with our engineers, and we're looking, you know, even at hiring more people on staff that have that type of experience to scale to that level. So I would say that's like a lesson we've learned is that like, hey, we knew we were going, but in a great way, sales came in before us. And so now we're like, you know, we're working and scaling with them side by side.
So that's interesting. So there's a theme here around sort of proactive hiring or hiring the right people earlier than maybe you had anticipated. So let's rewind the tape a little bit. And, you know, you were talking about scaling up the engineering org and having this sort of distributed pod model, not having the layering, you know, early on. If you were to go back and do it again, when or at what point or what signal would you have said, okay, now's the time to start distributing the team, putting in layering, delegating, and so on?
Yeah, I mean, every company's different scale, right? But once you start finding product market fit and it's like, oh my God, this is working. Like, let's scale up. Maybe you raise a B round of capital or whatever it is. Split the org into like two tracks. This is the engineering lens. Mm-hmm. Is like application development and platform engineering. And I think platform engineering, the purpose, at least the way I visualize it, is the customer are the application developers. And the application developers are building stuff for the customers. And that, I think, separation is helpful for just like a different mind state of the type of work that needs to get done. Because every time you need to go bug an application development pod, we're like, hey, we need, you know, XYZ or the pipeline is this or the database that or upgrade node for this or whatever it may be, it's limiting them and their capacity to innovate. And so I don't think we did that fast enough. We have an amazing platform team now, but it's like, I think I would have rather started that just a little earlier. I think that would have helped us.
So that's interesting. Yeah. I think the theme here that we're talking about is building capacity. Right, is having capacity before you're redlining it or running it to the rails. I have to deal with this a lot with my coaching clients, especially anyone that's coming out of the startup phase where you're so, you know, cost conscious and trying to make, you know, whatever, they're still eating ramen and paying yourself no salary and just thinking every dollar counts. Yeah. It's so hard for me as a coach to kind of help shift this mindset of you're actually trying to make investments in the future and building a capacity that you can grow into as opposed to stretching every resource super thin. And product market fit is that inflection point.
Yes, for sure. The balance will be, again, so if your job is to like scale people like myself and mm-hmm. get us to think a little differently, even though I'm running a bigger company now, this is my eighth company I've started. You're never going to take it away from me. So I do worry about every dollar that we spend, even though it's more than your average Series A startup. And that's, I think, just, you know, maybe it's a flaw of mine. Maybe it helped us get where we're at today. So maybe it's not a flaw, but like, I just have that concern of like, don't overhire and like no one's right. But you were asking me questions of where maybe you would change. So it wouldn't be like the whole org, but certain key moments, it's like, yeah, maybe I should have hired a VP earlier. Maybe I should have split platform or engineering a little earlier. But then I look back and it's like, maybe those would have been the wrong hires and you deal with 6 months of crap and like it slows us down and we didn't get to where we're at. So, you know, hindsight's 2020, but, I think it is similar what you said, like capacity. And I work really closely with our ops and sales and go-to-market team. And I see them do that amazingly is they work, you know, they project and ops like models all this amazing stuff, whether it's, you know, through financial models or even we're doing like predictive models using machine learning and stuff. Like, it's really cool to see. And they look at the capacity forward and it's like, hey, okay, we want to go hit X million in new enterprise pipeline. We actually got to go hire 3 more enterprise sellers or whatever the number is. And it's like, it's very sophisticated and it does become even, it's funny, even though they're all humans and they're trying to build their lives and their families and support whatever, it's like, when you look at the capacity model, it's like, it's just a numbers game. It's a machine.
Yeah.
And so engineering and product a little different because it's like teamwork and it's like nuance of it. But at the same time, you can break it down to capacity and delivery and, you know, quantification of estimation and
So I coach a lot of CTOs as well, and there's often this pattern where the CTOs kind of have to fight for every hire, you know, because CEOs are always thinking, it's already too expensive, or it couldn't possibly take that long or to be that hard, or whatever it is. And so CTOs are always having to kind of fight for this capacity. So one of the ways I kind of help them deal with it is to create a kind of a model where it starts with the sales projection. It's like, we're gonna, you know, 10x the number of customers on our platform.
Yeah.
And they say, okay, well, if we're 10xing the load and the demand on our systems, then this is how we're going to have to scale up the systems and the teams and so on to meet that demand. Yeah. I'm right there with you. Of course, we're going to get 10 times as many customers. Of course, we're going to 10x our revenue and all that.
Yeah.
Okay. So in order to do that, we're going to have to build out this platform. We're going to have to build out this team and whatnot. And then it becomes well, are you sure? Yeah. You really need all that? Yeah. Is it really going to take that long? Couldn't be that hard, could it?
Yeah.
So even just sort of, I do a lot of like role playing, you know, so I role play as that skeptic and try to, you know, get my coaching clients to stand up for themselves. Right. And fight for the resources that are needed.
Yeah. On the just for all the listeners, I would say not a mistake, but one thing I wish, and a lot of people ask me that, like what, especially internally, like our sales engineers or our new engineers, they would say like, what is one thing you would have changed like at the system level? And I think the one thing I would have changed, even though I love MySQL and the MySQL community, it served the internet very well. It still probably runs the majority of databases online. I think the community around like relational database storage has shifted more towards Postgres. So not, I mean, I think very like Postgres and MySQL, very, very similar. I'm sure, I know there's differences, but the community has, and like the tool sets around it and companies around it has shifted more towards Postgres. We start on MySQL and we could like move to Postgres, but you know, it'd be an effort and you're not doing something else otherwise. But so not saying go pick Postgres, but what I'm saying is when you pick these technologies, whether it's your programming language or your data storage, your cloud provider, like make sure the community is really strong around them. And where is the market going in like 3-5 years? And I think that's one thing that I didn't look at with MySQL. Like even 5 years ago when we started Drata, it was like the community was pushing towards Postgres. And so now, again, MySQL is great, and there's so much tooling for, you know, whatever, 3-4 decades. But like,
That's a really interesting insight. So also the community is tied into the talent pool. I mean, they're the same people.
Exactly. Yeah.
So one of the things that I always, as I'm a former CTO myself, so I dealt with this, you know, as technology developed. I mean, I'm an old sort of Java programmer. And then as the world moved to, you know, PHP and Node and so on, I ran into this mindset of like, well, as I'm hacking the, you know, the MVP and I'm building it in the language that I'm familiar with, I've got to then go be able to hire a team that can build and extend that thing. And so this was an epiphany that I had in my career. And now again, it's something that I make sure my clients are thinking through as well.
Yeah.
Choosing your tech stock is not always about which technology, certainly not which is the newest and coolest or whatever, but it's not even necessarily about the one that is the best to solve the specific problem.
Yeah.
It's also about the talent pool, the availability and the price of good talent that you can hire to build it.
I mean, Python was like declining, and with the boom of machine learning and AI, it's like, it's on the rise now.
I'm an old data scientist as well. So I've spent, you know, lots and lots and lots of time doing Python. And then when, you know, then, so Django became popular for a moment and everyone was like trying to build full stack applications on Python. I said, weird, but okay. All right, fine. Yeah, let's do it. But then within a couple of years, all of a sudden you couldn't find anybody that could build for it.
No.
Right. And because, you know, everybody went to become machine learning developers.
Yeah, like same with the Ruby on Rails stack. And like, it was the hot mess. And then Ruby started dying and all the package management went to JavaScript and.
Into Node. Yeah, totally. So, I mean, that's, you know, I don't know if there's a good answer to that necessarily, because I mean, the technology does shift and, you know, people will try to, I think main thing is just not to make it about you, that if you're a CTO or you're a technical founder, don't build your tech stack just based off of what you know.
Yeah.
Focus it on what the, where, like you said, where the industry, where the communities are going and where the talent's available for sure. Yeah. So I'm going to zoom out a little bit. You know, before we wrap up, I love to kind of hear from you what your leadership principles or leadership style is, you know, as a leader of you know, hundreds of engineers, what are the things that are sort of the most core to your beliefs?
Absolutely. I may be a little unique, but it's, like leading on the battlefield. It's hard to do at scale. Some could say I'm at scale, and then I go look at peers at Netflix and whatnot, and I'm nowhere near at scale compared to them. Mm-hmm. But like, if you're just in your throne and telling people what to do, I don't think there's a need for a CTO. It's like a different role, right? Mm-hmm. If you want to be the technical leader, you need to be technical. And with the adoption changing of technologies all the time, I mean, AI wasn't a buzz craze till 3.5 years ago, right? Like, are you keeping up to date? Are you on the floor? Are you in the architecture reviews? Are you still coding? Like last night, here's a great example. Last night there was kind of an issue and one of my teams, it wasn't declared as a critical or anything. The team was like, cool, I'm going to go put it in our next sprint. That sounds normal. And one of my CS leaders was like, what's going on with this? Like, hit me up. I'm like, no, you're right. Let's go do it. And so I hit people up on the weekend and it was like, guys, what's the plan here? They're like, hey, it's not critical or whatever. We're going to do it next sprint. I'm just like, I'll just go do it. So last night it was like midnight and it took me 20 minutes and I got a PR and they're reviewing and testing and deploying today. And so it's like, I'm not in the weeds of like, I'm not a developer member of a pod and doing features, but for like incidents, issues, architecture reviews, how do you like infrastructure, picking the right vendors, like why? Just why on everything. And if you don't keep up to date with the technology and be involved, you're not going to build the trust with your team. They're not going to, and you're not going to be able to like advise correctly as you continue to grow. I think I see that with a lot of technology leaders on my side. It's like they've gotten so elevated in their career where it's like orchestration of people, but not the technology.
Yeah. Do you have a VP of engineering or even multiple people that are sort of building and running the day to day?
Yeah, for sure. So there's like a group over the application development group. There's platform engineering, data, our CISO, QA leader, program leader. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is, you know, a trope in the life, in the journey of a CTO is if and when to hire VP of engineering and focus on the architecture, yeah, or to be really the one that's kind of leading and driving the engineering team itself. That's why that kind of split ends up happening. But, you know, what you're saying is this goes back to what you're talking about, like how wishing that you had hired, yeah, a little bit earlier. Were you talking about those leaders that are going to build? So that allows,
yeah,
you to,
it is, yeah, but it's not like, don't pass the buck to them. Like you still, mm-hmm, got to lead it, but they can take care of a lot of the day to day for sure. And then like, how does information flow up? So the, even our like ceremonies are very structured to like, from the pod to a squad to a pillar up to me, and like how information flows up and down. It's all very, mm-hmm, methodical of like, I don't want anyone in more than two standups a day. And we just want to try to maximize time to get to engineering and effort and to the customer. That's the end of the day. That's the goal.
Yeah. Fantastic. Well, Daniel, we're out of time. It's been such a pleasure talking to you. I love chatting, mm-hmm, with a fellow CTO as well, and get to dive into the weeds a little bit. But yeah, best of luck to you. I hope you guys scale up and become, mm-hmm, a serious San Diego unicorn, and then you know, come back and give back to the community through Startup San Diego.
Yes, sir.
All right. Great to talk to you, man.
Hey, I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you are a tech CEO or CTO and you're looking to go from chaos to clarity, for over 20 years, I've helped over 100 companies like OpenAI, Sony, Qualcomm, and Automatic develop market-leading products, lead high-performing teams, and raise a boatload of money. So if you want to lead magnetically, scale smoothly, and fundraise effortlessly, go to chaostoclarity.io. I've got a ton of free resources and content to help you grow your business.